My guest today, Miles Chandler Watson, is on a mission to take fencing mainstream. A British-born, 6'4" black man covered in tattoos with bleach blonde hair, he breaks pretty much every generation's old assumption and mold about what the staid, traditionally conservative, and often elitist sport is all about. Miles actually struggled a lot as a kid, especially with focus and attention and school, until one day a teacher introduced him to fencing. That moment for him, well, it changed everything. He was obsessed, and it gave him this physicalized way to learn and to develop intense focus that soon changed everything in his life and became a bit of a driving force. Miles wanted to be the best in the world and win the Olympics, and indeed, already a world champion and an Olympic medalist, he's well on his way. Miles also decided to redefine the public perception of the sport, to make it more modern and alive and high profile, really appealing to a younger generation, especially those like him who were often excluded from the pursuit. And he's on a mission to also reimagine the financial side of the pursuit, introducing a level of popular appeal, relevance, and excitement that's landed him huge social media followings and big endorsement deals with brands like Coach and Red Bull. So excited to share this conversation with you. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good Life Project is brought to you by Understood Explains, a podcast that's like a beacon for parents navigating the special education system. Hosted by Juliana Urtube, a special education expert, this season is all about individualized education plans, or IEPs. Juliana breaks down complex topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP in a way that's easy to grasp. I checked out an episode of Understood Explains about the difference between IEPs and 504 plans, and I was struck by the balance of empathy and practical advice. It's not just about understanding the system. It's about empowering parents and caregivers to advocate for their children, which is just so important. So I've known a number of people who've had to literally scramble to figure out how to advocate for their kids when the system seemed to just make it so hard to get the support that they need and deserve. So if you're a parent navigating this world, or even just wondering if it's right for your family, I encourage you to give Understood Explains a listen. Search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains. It's like having a roadmap for a journey you didn't expect, making it a little less daunting.
You're up in Vancouver doing some training, but pretty much raised in New York. But I guess even before that, born in London or around London. Tell me a little bit about sort of early life for you before you headed to the States.
I was born in London, born in between Brixton and Ealing Broadway, which is like kind of outside London. I was playing football growing up. That's kind of the only sports that football, rugby, cricket. It's kind of what London is known for. And then my mother met my stepdad, who's my dad. And he was like, hey, I'm moving back to New York City. You want to come? And she's like, yes. And I was like, no, I did not want to go. I was 10. You know, it's like the prime age when you all your friends are there. And so that really kind of sucked for me. And I get thrown right into public school in the middle of the year because we kind of moved, I would say, like January, February, like a weird time, right into public school. And I was obviously like a kind of pain in the butt, like an ant in my pants kid. So I was kind of getting into trouble all the time. And I got kicked out of the public school, PS 37, hello. And then my mother met this lady who was in the admissions program for the Dwight School, which is a private school. And I was like, okay, let's give it a shot. Let's kind of try it out and see what happens. And I got in by my charm. And as punishment, well, not punishment, as like a stipulation or whatever you want to call it, I had to pick up tennis, badminton, or fencing from 3 to 4:30 as like my extra curriculum punishment. I was like, whatever, swords are fun. Have fun with this. And I was like, oh, wow, like I can stab you and not get into trouble. Like, this is quite fun. And then I just slowly started to get better in school and just kind of fell in love with the sport of fencing, just the art of, you know, one-on-one combat, like a little superhero. And then, you know, that was when I really started to take the sport seriously when I moved to America.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like also, I know you describe yourself as I remember reading this quote, very ADHD, super crazy, couldn't sit still. You couldn't tell me anything. I was this hothead kid from London. When you end up at Dwight, it sounds like also part of what was going on with you is learning struggles and attention struggles.
Yep.
And so part of the fencing then, was that required? Was the sport required for everyone? Or were people looking at you and saying, hey, listen, this kid needs to be, he needs to explore the world and to learn and like to move his body in a way that's different in order to sort of like allow him to sort of be able to focus back in and be himself?
Yeah. So great question. So I honestly think it was someone they saw as like this kid kind of ADHD, ADD, dyslexic, whatever you want to call him. Let's give him a sport where he kind of has to figure things out, right? Because fencing's like chess and boxing. You have to use your mind, but also you have to kind of think ahead. So I think they saw this as like, I mean, most kids weren't fencing, you know, like I think it was select few, maybe like 10 kids in my class. And I think that's kind of what they saw in me. And the lady named Ellen Grayson is the woman who changed my life. She was like, Miles, I think not only can you get into college. And I was like, college, what's that? In London's like university. I was like, I didn't think that was even a possibility. And then that's when I really was like, okay, this sport is not just like the parent trap. It's really got some beautiful combat, but like mental warfare that kind of encumbers into one umbrella. And I think that is what drew me to the sport.
Yeah. Do you remember the first time you picked up, I don't know if it would have been a foil back then or whatever it was. Like, do you remember having an immediate reaction or a sense that like, oh, this is different?
I do. So we were in the gym and it was foam swords, like foam swords. Like I was like 11. You couldn't even like actually use the real ones yet. So it's foam. We were like hitting each other in the head with them. And she's like, Miles, like pay attention. I'll never forget. I was like, I'm sorry. And then I was like, when do we get to use the real ones? And she was like, you know, when you get to a certain level. I was like, okay. And then that was when I was like, I want to try the real sword. So it was like maybe 2 weeks to 3 weeks of this foam sword kind of, but I'll never forget it. It was like this little gym and there were padded walls. I don't know why they're padded walls. And it was like 10 of us in the class and anything from 10 to 14. And that was my first memory of the sport.
Yeah. And it sounds like for you, the like you immediately had a goal. You're kind of like, okay, I want to be done with the foam.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, okay, this is kind of fun, but like, where's the real shebang? And that's when I was like, oh, it's possible. So just kind of keep going. And then now we're here. It's, honestly, like, it's a wild ride.
Yeah. I mean, when you pick it up at 10 or 11 years old, right? There are 10 kids in the class. Dwight is a well-known school in New York City. Was fencing kind of an unusual thing for kids to do there? Or how is it looked at with your fellow students?
Oh, it's not a cool thing. It's not like, you fence? No, but I was like, what's wrong with that? I was like, you put a ball in the hoop. Cool. You know, like no disrespect to anybody playing basketball. I love that sport too. But I was like, what's so not cool about playing with swords, you know what I mean? I was like, I basically wanted to be a superhero and turn that into my passion, into my job, essentially. So you get made fun of all the time. Oh, what did you play with sticks today? And I'm like, mate, oh, you just wait. And then that kind of fueled me into this, what I am now, I think, was people telling me, you know, what are you going to do with this sport? Like, what are you going to do with it? Are you going to make any money? It's not cool. You know, like, are you going to get any girls? And I'm like, well, girls aren't like a sword fighter, you know? I said, I was like, okay. And then that's kind of what fueled me at that age. It's like, oh, you don't think I can do this? Watch. And then it went and turned into a different animal then.
Yeah, so it's almost like people saying, okay, you're doing something that's not all that acceptable, not all that cool. It's not going to give you status or money or power or relationships. So why bother doing it? And you're like just, and that for you, it's interesting because especially as a kid in the teens where you've just come from another country, you really just want to be accepted. A lot of kids would have probably caved and said, let me just do whatever's going to let me fit in the most here. And for you, it was the exact opposite. You're like, no, I'm going to show them all.
I never forget these people's faces. Oh my God. They were like, dude, pick up something cool, man. You're from London. Play soccer. And I was like, what's soccer? It's football, first off. And I was playing football too at the same time until about 14 as well. Then I was like, you know what? You guys should have never fueled this beast because I'm not stopping. And then I was like, and I started to get better in school, right? As I started to dedicate more time to fencing, I started to get into less trouble. And then once I found fencing, boom, 9/11 hits. And I'm like, oh, like my stepdad who's working in finance at the time was working at the World Financial Center, which was right next to the World Trade Center. He's late that morning. I mean, crazy. Couldn't even. And everybody got fired. So we had no job, nothing. So we had to move to Philadelphia. And get ready for this. They throw me into a Quaker school. And I'm like, what is Quaker? I'm like, oats? Like, yeah. And when I tell you that didn't last very long, I'll kick that right away. You basically have to sit still for, I think it's 20 minutes a day for meeting for worship. And I'm just like, guys, all due respect, this is not working for me. You call your teachers by their first name, like, hey, Steve. I'm like, this is weird. It's a very Amish kind of way, I think, still, or it was back then. I think a lot of Amish kids were there. And I just was so out of place. A London kid who fenced. I don't know. Like, no one even knew what that meant. They thought I put up fences. I'm not even kidding you. They thought I put up fences for a living.
Yeah. I mean, by the time you moved to Philly, so that would have been 2001, right? Yeah. So did you identify, because there's a point where people tend to say, oh, I do this thing. And then it becomes so much a part of you that you start saying, I am a. So instead of saying like, oh, like I fence, you say, I am a fencer. It becomes like an identity level thing, like sort of like so core to who you are. By the time that you moved to Philly, do you feel like you had made that transition, or were you still sort of like earlier on? Like it was just something you do. It wasn't so much something that you are.
Yeah, I don't think it was until I would say 14, 15. So yeah, I'll tell you about the journey. So I was in Philadelphia, right?
Yeah.
Nobody fenced. The atmosphere was just, didn't like it. And I was like, Mom, I need to go back to New York City. She was like, well, okay, well, there's two trains you can take. So I would take off to school. This is when I realized I am a fencer. This is when it changed for me. I would go off to school. I would leave at 2:10 and I would catch the 2:20 train from Paoli, which is like out by there. And I would go from Paoli to 30th Street Station. I'd take three trains. I'd go from the 30th Street Station to Trenton on New Jersey on SEPTA. And then I'd take New Jersey Transit from Trenton to Penn Station. It was like 3 hours of train. And I get there at like 5:30, take a 6 p.m. class till like 8:39. Then I take the train back and I get home around 11. It was twice a week on my own. This is when I was like, I'm a fencer. Like, this is my job. Like, people thought I was crazy. Literally, people thought I was mad. My mom was like, okay, you're insane. I was like, yeah, just let me be. I want to do this. And then I was like, I can't do this anymore. I can't go to Quaker school. Thank God I got kicked out. And then from there, I am about 15. I go to a boarding school in Long Island. And I was like, all right, Mom, love you. Bye. And I was like, this is it. And I would go every day from 3 to 8. And I would dedicate my life to the sport at 16. on my own. I come back late. It was weird. I had to like wait for like someone to pick me up from the school or take a taxi on my own. It was like some very lonely time because I was on my own. I didn't have any like friends at the time. Well, I had a lot of friends, but like not really friends who understood what I was doing. And you had to be in bed by 10, but they let me stay up till 11 to finish my work. So you miss out on a lot. Didn't go to any dances, or I went to one prom just because all I wanted was to be the best at the sport.
Yeah. When did you start to realize, I mean, obviously, you know, when you're traveling on a train back and forth for hours and hours a day, twice a week from Philly to New York, just to do this thing, something clicks in your brain that says, okay, this is bigger. You know, like this isn't just something I do for fun. Like this is a part of who I am. And then you end up in this boarding school in Long Island. Did you have a sense for where you wanted this to lead you? Like, was there even a path that like people that was clear to you?
Yes, I wanted to go to the Olympics. I remember seeing some guys at my club that, coincidentally enough, one of them is my coach now, that I wanted to go to the Olympics. That was it. I wanted to, actually, I never forget this, because in school, they'd write you like, what do you want to do? Like, it was to become world champion and Olympic champion, because nobody in the history of my sport has ever done either. I mean, for an American at the time, or somebody from London or British person. It was always Italians or Russians or French or Chinese. So that's when I was like, okay, I want to be the best it's ever been. And then that's when I was like, nothing's going to stop me until I get there.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Good Life Project is sponsored by NetSuite. So I remember when our businesses were just starting to really scale. It was amazing and also added complexity and stress. And the things that I used to do in hours were taking days, too many spreadsheets, too many systems, no single source of truth. If that sounds familiar, you should know these numbers. 37,000. 25 and 1. 37,000 businesses have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25. NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And 1, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all of your key performance indicators in one efficient system with one source of truth, manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need to grow, all in
one place. And right now, download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/goodlife. That's netsuite.com/goodlife to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/goodlife.
When you start competing, tell me about the culture, because I think, you know, you talk about basketball, football, baseball, soccer, like all the sort of like mainstream sports with big professions around it and crowds and stuff like that. I think everyone has a sense for what the culture is around the sport. But fencing is a whole different world. You know, it's sort of, I feel like it's almost invisible to almost everybody except for the people who fence. You know, we've heard this thing exists. We know that certain people at Ivy League universities do it. Certain, you know, like elite clubs, I guess, but people just don't have any sense. Tell me a little bit of just sort of like about the culture of the sport.
So the culture of the sport is still very elitist, predominantly white, right? Still has that of just, you do it in college and, you know, it's very stuffy. And there's not many people that are black or mixed race or whatever you want to call it, you know, that look like me. So it's very a judgmental culture. It's very like, you have to have a lot of money to kind of get into the sport. I'm lucky that I found Ellen Grayson, who helped me out. But the stigma is very, you know, let's go to a fencing match, let's drink some champagne, let's wear a suit and watch them fence. That's kind of what it is, what it still is. So my goal when I was seeing these competitions was, this has to change. There needs to be more diversity, there needs to be more energy, there needs to be, why your competition is not broadcast on TV? Like, this is crazy. So I was like, you know, like, we need to change this. And that's what I kind of set out my mission to be, was, this has to change. Because it's such an inaccessible sport, really.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like for you, there was a love of the sport itself, but you sort of like widened your lens too, mm-hmm. and said, there's a bigger issue here. It's really exclusionary. And also just not getting a lot of attention. And like you said, you know, earlier in our conversation, this is sword fighting. It's actually pretty cool.
Exactly.
Like, why would this be like kept in this tiny little, you know, like pocket over here, and only certain people can do it and only certain people watch it? So your mission was bigger.
Way bigger, yeah. And I was like, you know what? When I'm done with the sport, it will never be the same. And it won't be.
if people could see the smile that just went across your face.
I mean, we have a long ways to go, but we're on the right track, you know. But it takes someone to kind of break those barriers down. That might not be easy, but I'm grateful for like support of all my sponsors who saw me and the vision, and people that have kind of helped open doors for me. So I don't forget anybody along the journey, but we still have a long ways to go still.
Yeah. I mean, and you mentioned the sport is predominantly white, or was, and it sounds like still is, sort of like white men. You coming into it in the early days, when you start to actually enter competition, did you sense any either quiet or overt racism or anything that where you like felt uncomfortable simply because of who you were?
Yeah. I mean, I'm also just different. Like, I don't care about, I mean, I obviously see it all the time. It's, I don't know why it never affected me. But the weird thing is like, it's the referees who don't want you to win or be on the podium, right? And it's like, if you make it so clear, they can't do anything. And I would see it all the time. I would never forget the time. I hope this guy listens to this podcast. I don't even remember his name. I was 15 and I was number one in the country, right? And I had to make a top eight in the Junior Olympics to qualify for the World Championships. So, it's easy. I get ninth in the juniors because this man gave me nine red cards. That's 9 points against me. It goes to 15 points. And when I tell you, when I felt so helpless, I'm a 15-year-old kid, and I was like, why is this happening? And then my coach was like, it's because you're black. And I was like, what do you mean? He was like, yeah, there's never been someone on your team like that. I was like, what? Who cares? And then I was like, oh, wow. And I was so angry. Like, this is one time I was really angry. I never forget this. We're in Cleveland, Ohio. Oh, and I had food poisoning that day too. And then the next day was the under 17, which was the team I was trying to make. And when I tell you, I won and I killed everyone, but I missed the team by 2 points. I sat in the drug testing room because we first ever get drug tested. And I was like, so happy because I thought I qualified, right? And then the point system, boom, whatever, I didn't qualify. And I was like, I will never have this taste in my mouth again. And since that day, I made 15 straight teams. And that's when the first time I was like, okay, I'm going to make sure this never happens to another kid like me, because maybe another kid might not be strong enough to come back and be, you know? And that was one of many where really stuck in my mind. I see this guy still to this day. I still see him in competitions, and I don't even let him come near me. He can't even come near me anymore. I have to talk to my coach, my people around me, just because I don't even want to give you access. That guy really pissed me off.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. As you were talking, I was thinking about Olympic gymnasts, actually, and how, you know, in theory, you know, everything is just, you know, you tally up the points and whoever gets the most points wins. But really, it's so subjective underneath that, because you can either award or not award points. And then there was, when I was a kid, I was a gymnast and I competed aggressively until I was about 20. And I remember they would reward what they called virtuosity points. And this was where subjectively they could either give you points or punish you because it just didn't like who you were or your style or the things you do. Wow. And you saw some gymnasts actually in the last decade at the Olympic level getting punished because they were different from the mold. You know, they were different from the culture and the expectation. It's funny because I didn't realize until you just shared it that that exists in fencing too, because I kind of figured everyone gets points. Like it's based purely on a number system. You know, like the touches happen. Everyone knows it because the foils are wired to trigger it. But I had no idea that people could subjectively really interfere with that whole process.
So our sport, I would say, besides gymnastics, which is the most subjective and insane thing I've ever seen, because I watched at the Olympics and Simone's always a good friend of mine, always girls. But our sport is referee. So if someone doesn't like you, he can literally just say, I'm the referee. And, you know, like he might get banned the next tournament, but he can literally do what he wants. You know, we have some great referees as well, amazing one. There's some who, you know, might not like your style, might not like who you are or how big you're getting. You know, it's just some people just don't like that. So, yeah, and it's hard to get a one light action, right? My coach is like, make it a one light. I'm like, I wish I could every time. It's not that easy. But there's a lot of subjectiveness in my sport, which is kind of what I'm trying to eliminate somehow. So I'm working with my sponsors to kind of figure out how we make it way more clean cut, because it's not fair.
Yeah. But I mean, when you think about where you've been and sort of like what you've built also, I'm curious for you what your experience is of the actual process. So like if you think about stepping into a match, and I may get the language wrong, so correct me if I'm wrong. There's sort of like this one boundaried area called the piste where you kind of, you know, you move back and forth with your opponent on it. Tell me about the feeling that you get. I'm so curious about what happens to not just you, but people when they sort of almost like, quote, step into the ring at a really high level of competition. I'm curious whether you have any, you know, rituals that sort of like you embrace as you're getting ready and then step into it, and whether you sense that there's any sort of like almost emotional or psychological shift that happens.
Yeah. So I used to do this thing where I used to take a bath before every tournament. My roommate would be like, what are you doing? And I just take a bath and I put on music and I would just like visualize myself on the podium or just like actions, right? So like, because they're going to happen. And if you know they're going to happen, you're prepared for them, right? So I'd always understood that the mind is everything, right? The mind is everything. So if you can somehow understand that like things are going to happen, but stay the course no matter what, because if the referee makes a call and you don't like it, you're going to get mad. It's going to ruin your whole everything. And I'd always put on music. I made playlists before. I was never a big eater before I fenced. I got like somewhat nervous. Well, I like to be light on my feet. You know, like these guys would eat food and stuff, and I had a coffee, a banana, and some bread, some eggs or something, but like very light. And I'd always visualize. I was just like, I'm gonna, you know, visualize my actions in my head, and then I just turn into this person who you couldn't even get into my brain. Like you could be yelling at me and I won't even hear you. It's just this, that's the definition of being in the zone. And the hard part is getting into the zone before you start. some days you're not on, and some days you are. And then as I started to get older, I started to realize how important this is. This is easy to train. Fencing is easy to train, but this is a whole other animal. So I started to meditate. I started to visualize. I started to draw. I started to paint the picture literally of who I'm going to go up against. The night before, I'd manifest myself just destroying you in my room in a weird town in Germany or a weird town in Italy, just manifesting. And then I was just like, Miles, have fun. Just go for it. Like, don't think twice. And always go with your first option. And that's what I did.
That's so interesting. So it's almost like a three-part ritual. So like there's the bad thing to just relax. Then there's the mental intense focus, like the visualization and the focus and the meditative aspect to it. But then it sounds like when it's actually time for you to step into the experience, you just let it all go and just be like, let me just be fully present in the moment.
Fully present, fully free, just have fun. My coach is like, play with purpose. That's what he always tells me. And it's just like, if you can just play, but with purpose, that fine line, that sweet spot is just, oh, it's beautiful. It's not easy to get there all the time, obviously, but if you can get into that sweet spot, oh my God, that's what you live for. And it's just like, I'm just getting started in my sport, I think, myself, which is scary, but I think I haven't tapped into what I'm going to be able to do yet.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing that everything leading up to it is the mindset of a warrior and ferocity. And then when you're actually in it, it's the mindset of a kid just playing.
Exactly. Like being a kid, because kids are so pure, right? Kids don't know any better. They just do what they feel. If you can be that kid all the time, you're so dangerous, because kids have no fear. If you can have that aspect of a kid, but also the mind of an adult, I think you're so dangerous.
Yeah. When you step into the match, do you feel like, I've heard a lot of competitors describe it as almost like they're stepping into another identity or another personality.
Mm-hmm.
Does that happen to you? I'm curious.
Every time I put the mask on, I'm a superhero. When I put this down, I'm a different person. Like, I can joke with you and have fun with you. And when I'm, you know, in the green room or just chilling, this is what I like to do. I like to mess with my opponents all the time. I'll just joke with them and I'll be, oh, look, you know. And then once it's game over, I'm just, honestly, it's crazy. My coach is like, dude, are you two different people? I'm like, I don't know. But it's like, it's so important to be able to like get into that mindset of just like, and then when it's game on, boom. And then when you're done, forget about it. Have fun. My coach is like, have fun. Walk around. And then when an hour before, let's get back into the zone.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of almost having an alter ego. I know I actually have some friends who do that, and they have little names for their alter ego. And a friend of mine actually wrote a book about this phenomenon. He calls it the alter ego effect. And what's interesting is he would share that a lot of people who access this, especially high-level athletes, they have some sort of item that sort of like turns you from, you know, the Clark Kent to the superhero type of person. For one of them, it's a pair of glasses. It sounds like for you, it's the mask. Like when the mask lowers down over you, it's sort of like that is the thing that allows you to step into superhero mode.
It is. I just turned into a different person. It's like no matter what's going on in the world or my life or meeting, when I'm on this, all I'm thinking about is you, as the opponent. So things, why it's so powerful, why sports like changed lives, you know, because you can get out whatever you give in. So if you want to work your, like, also, you'll be rewarded. Might take time, but it's why sports are so hard, but also so beautiful at the same time.
Yeah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Fencing is also really interesting, right? Because similar to gymnastics, you're both an individual competitor, but you're also part of a team.
Yeah.
And I know that's been a big part of your experience. You know, like when you are in a match, it's just you and the other person, like nothing else exists. But in the larger context, you're still a part of this group of people. And both, it seems like both play a really important role in who you are and what you love about it.
Huge deal. And I think they go hand in hand. We can't be one without the other. So it's very, yeah, there's so much to learn. Like every day I learn more and more about just yourself or life or whatever that might be just by practicing, you know? It's crazy.
Yeah. You're competing and you're doing well. You know, you're really kind of rising up when you're younger. You end up at Penn State continuing to fence through your whole time there. And along the way, you start to compete at super high levels. Curious what, you know, you sort of shared in the early days what the perception was of the fencers when you were younger. When you're in college, did that change or was it sort of like an extension of the early perception?
It was a little bit the same. But I think because we, A, I won a lot, and B, like Penn State, like they were national champions, like way before I came. So like they had the stigma of being a team that wins no matter what. So when I went to Penn State, it was like, you weren't really made fun of that much. And then I went to the Olympics right when I got there. So that kind of changed a lot for me. I was like, you know, it's incredible, you know? So I was also on a different playing field than everybody else because I was never in school because I was always traveling for my Olympic team. So I didn't finish school, obviously, because I signed to Nike. But like Penn State, they were amazing. I love that school. And they were amazing with accommodating me and making sure that like, I was competing for NCAAs, but also I was competing for my Olympic team and my World Championship team. So I was going to Ohio State one weekend and I was going to Italy the next weekend. So I was literally never in school. So I missed out a lot there too. I missed out a lot on that stuff. And I come back Sundays. I have to go right into training on Monday, into work. So it was, I didn't want to go to college, honestly. I didn't think I needed to, but I wanted to get the experience for at least a year or two.
Yeah. Was that weird for you, though? I mean, I can't imagine sort of like you're hanging out with your friends in college, you know, and you're a freshman in college. We all know like freshman life in college or sophomore life. You're hanging out, you're in Pennsylvania, and then you kind of vanish for 3 days. You're over in Italy competing, and then you come back and you're like, oh, 9 a.m. class. That must have been so strange for you.
I was honestly living in a different world because nobody could relate to what I was doing. I'd literally be fencing all, I have to like win NCAAs and I have to try and win the world championships and I like have all those obligations and I like have to still be eligible for school and I try and see my friends and all that. And I mean, I can't complain, but it was a lot to juggle for sure.
Yeah. So you show up freshman year, you end up in the Olympics. So you're what, 19 something, somewhere around there, right?
I was 20 at my first Olympics. Yeah.
Right. So here's the thing that you've been working towards. You've been telling people you're going to for years now. And the first time you go and you show up there, like you step off the plane, you step into the Olympic Village. What's that like for you?
For me, it was surreal because it was in my hometown. It was in London. So like my grandma, my nan saw me, my aunts, my uncles, my hooligan mates who were like, oh, you're in the Olympics, bro. Like who have never changed. We work at pubs, you know, and they were like, so it was honestly the most surreal experience for me because it was my hometown. So my first tattoo was from London to London with the rings on it underneath it, you know, because it's like, so for me, it was extra special. And I will never forget opening ceremony. I will never forget that experience for the rest of my life. It was crazy.
Yeah. Tell me about the experience also. So you're there. I mean, just getting there in the first place. And like you said, it's London. This is, you know, like your hometown. That alone is really powerful in the opening ceremony. When you finally step into your first match, when you're like, okay, so this has been fun. This is awesome. I love hanging out with all these like people who are world renowned and it's an amazing community. But now it's time to actually do the thing that I have been not only training to do for life, but telling people like, this is where I want to be. And in the moment where you actually step in and say, okay, this is time. What does that feel like for you?
You don't really know. It's, there's no word. It's just surreal, right? Because you walk out there and you see everyone, like 15,000 people just screaming for you. It was funny because so the announcer was cool, actually. He was like, Britain's own, but not really. Coming out of the United States, so like I had Great Britain kind of behind me and America. But it was again amazing. You know, I had a great first match, second match, and third match. The second match was when I fenced this Egyptian kid who, never forget, I debuted the new Nike. I had these vaults, which is like highlighter green shoes, highlighter green socks. And I remember changing the way I fenced for some reason. Something switched in me, right? I put too much pressure on myself. I wasn't having fun. I was tense. And I knew, I was like, this is going to be tough. And I beat this kid 15-3 before. And he ended up getting second. His first ever medal. He got silver medal at the Olympics. He almost won the Olympics. Again. And I was so sad and pissed off. So sad. And I was like, all right, team, we got fourth. And I was like, oh my God, no, with no medal. I was like, and I told myself, I remember sitting outside the balcony with my teammate, Garrick, and I was like, I'm going to be world champion next year. He was like, okay. I don't know why I said that or how. And I just went into that season, like, just so determined. I was just like, it was the most mentally ready I've ever been. And I was the first American to ever become world champion. And I remember sitting on the podium and, like, crying, tears on my coach, hug my coach. And I was like, wow. And like, first ever American to win. Like, first ever African-American to win. I was like, I'm the first ever American to ever win. And I was like, that's when my life changed for me. But I needed to lose in the Olympics, unfortunately, to know what I had to do for the rest of my career, if that makes sense, which is a very painful lesson to learn. But if I didn't learn that lesson, I don't think I'd be where I am to this day with the success. When I was there, I thought everything was over. I was like, I'm going to back to Penn State, a loser. You know, I was like, I didn't want any of this gear anymore. That's how hard it was on myself. And then, like, oh, dude, you should be happy to be here. I was like, I don't care about being here. I want to win this thing. So that was like a weird switch for me.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you had that sort of that momentary shift in mindset that just says, okay, it's almost like snap out of it. You know, yes, this was brutal. You know, this was the exact opposite of what I wanted, but you're not done. Because a lot of people would be done at that point, but there was something in you that said, not only am I, you know, like not done, but next year, these next 12 months, I'm going to become the best I can.
I went to like just a different mode of just like who I wanted to be. And I knew when I won that, I was like, I'm leaving college. And then I won and then I got, and that was the first fencer that Nike ever signed, male fencer. And I was like, okay, wow. Sponsorship happened and then things just took off for me.
Yeah. Let's talk about that a little bit because I think it's really, it's interesting, right? So let's talk about the economics of fencing because, you know, when you look at a lot of sports, especially a lot of athletes that end up, you know, wanting to compete in the Olympics, the economics are kind of brutal, especially the ones where they're not sort of prepping for a pro career after in a giant league with potential huge paychecks and huge sponsors. What do the economics of fencing look like for most people? And then how did that change for you?
I mean, most kids live with their parents, and most kids work a job in fences for their second career, right? Most of them don't make money. Like, none of them have sponsors. Unless you're like in Europe or Asia where it's different, you're a government sport, you're taking care of your, you know, your celebrities. If you're in Russia, you win a medal, you're on billboards. In America, no. There's nobody that I looked up to that's like, oh, he's doing something cool. No one. In fencing, right? Because it's like, how do you make money? They're like, oh, let's just go to college and then I'll leave fencing and then make money. That's what most people think, because that's the only real economic benefit is to use fencing to get into college. So I was like, no. I was like, not that money matters, but I was like, hey, I want to be the first fencer to ever make $1 million. That was like something I was told myself when I was 16 to my mom. She looked at me like I was insane. But I was like, no, I'm going to change this. I was like, I'm going to be me, and I'm just going to change the sport. And then, you know, I think I'm on the way to doing that by just not only getting sponsors, but also putting fencing in the light that it's ever been in. TV, commercials, magazines, events, you know, like, so I was always the first to do that, all that stuff. And I think that's what brands also see me as, like, I'm someone who's taking fencing from niche to mainstream, right? But I'm also showing kids that if you're good enough at something, you can be great at anything. And this is something I was writing down yesterday in my little notebook over here. I told myself that I never want to be a statistic. I want to be an anomaly. A tattooed black fencer. Like, that sounds like you're seeing a unicorn in the streets. So that was, I think, what was the difference between me and everybody else is I did see the vision, even though it might be crazy. I saw the vision. And all I needed to do was see it myself. I didn't need anybody else to see it. Not my mom, not my dad, not my sisters, not. I was going to make it happen.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it in a weird way, the very things that you got punished for as a fencer in the earlier days especially were the same things that have let you kind of redefine the sport to a certain extent. You know, like who you are, the fact that you're like, yes, you know, like I'm 6'4" and I'm covered with tattoos and I'm going to be 100% me in this sport. Those were the things that punished you earlier because culturally, you know, like you quote, didn't fit. You know, so people would be able to express bias or judgment against you by in your scores. And yet those, the very things, the things that make you unique, individual in this sport are the ones that now are allowing you to draw sponsorship, to draw attention, to draw new people to it, to change the conversation. And so it's interesting how you sort of flipped the script to a certain extent.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, like, my goal is, you know, my foundation is to empower youth through fencing, right? Whether that means you're white, black, doesn't matter. I just hate wasted talent. So I want kids to see, if you're good enough, I'm going to find you and I'm going to take you on my wing. I'm going to make sure that you have none of these barriers that's going to stop you from reaching your goal. So that's what I just want to do. I want to inspire these kids to say, like, listen, Miles did it. I can do it too. That's all I want is that. So, because I never had someone go, oh, he did it. So if I can be these guys, these people that they look up to, then that's the reason why. That's the bigger reason. Bigger than any medal, by far. Way bigger than any medal is to inspire a kid to see him be like, oh, wow, I could do something. That's, for me, the greatest gift I could give someone.
Yeah. Was that shift in priorities something? Was there something that happened that made you say, you know what? There's something that's actually more important to me than winning competition? Or was it sort of just like a gradual evolution over time?
There was over time. I think, like, when I started to reach like this level where like I would go to competitions and people would like surround me or swarm me, like I go to Russia and people would start crying. I was like, why are you crying? You know, I was like, oh, you mean so much to me. And I was like, whoa. That's when I was like, I never knew I had this effect on people, right? Like, I never knew. So that's when I was like, oh, wow. It's not just you, Miles. Like, it's, you got to take this sport and, you know, use broad shoulders and take the sport on your back and let's give this thing a ride. That's when I was like, oh my God, like, I can really I have a real impact on the sport, you know? And that to me was the shift. Seeing people really like see me like in this light. And I was like, whoa. Makes you want to win more. You know, adds like adds a good pressure on you. I love pressure.
Yeah, apparently. When you think now, you know, so you've built this career now where you get to do the thing that you love to do. You have completely broken the mold and rebuilt it in a way where the economics actually work for you, where you have attracted high-level international sponsorship and also attention to not just you, but to the sport. And like you just shared, you know, a real commitment to turning around and then giving back and saying, or you know, combination of giving back and paying forward, saying you're like, okay, so I got here, but part of what I'm here to do is affect other people and open doors and show them what's going on. When you think about where you are right now, the opportunity that you have to play, you know, in the lives of so many different kids potentially, do you ever reflect on the early days, the moment where Ellen Grayson saw something in you that was different and sort of like encouraged you to change and to do something really different?
100%. Without her, I don't know where I'd honestly be. And now I can see, I can use what she gave me, the tools that she gave me, to use that onto other kids as well. And I see myself in some of these kids, you know? I'm like, oh, look at this kid. He wants to wear crazy hair. He wants to be different. I'm like, do that. You know, embrace who you are. And I think something too is like, I did a talk with Instagram and I was like, it's a great thing when people make fun of you. That's the number one form of jealousy. It means you know something right. So I always tell them, I'm like, the more hate, the more love that comes in the back end. So don't even worry about that, you know? Feed off of that. You know, so I always tell kids, I'm like, take the words C-A-N-T out of your vocabulary, work harder than anybody else in the world, and never lose sight of why you started the sport, no matter what. And that's a little peace of mind for Miles.
It feels like a good place for us to come full circle too. So hanging out in this container of Good Life Project, if I offer up the phrase to live a good life, what comes up?
To be generally content and happy. Because those are hard words to actually feel. You know, to be happy is like, oh, I'm like, are you happy? It's like to be happy is generally happy. Nothing beats that. If you're generally happy, nothing beats that.
Thank you.
Pleasure, man. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. And thanks also to our fantastic sponsors who help make this show possible. You can check them out in the links we have included in today's show notes. And while you're at it, if you've ever asked yourself, what should I do with my life? We have created a really cool online assessment that will help you discover the source code for the work that you're here to do. You can find it at sparkatype.com. That's sparkatype.com, or just click the link in the show notes. And of course, if you haven't already done so, be sure to click on the subscribe button in your listening app so you never miss an episode. And then share the love. If there's something that you've heard in this episode that you would love to turn into a conversation, share it with people and have that conversation. Because when ideas become conversations that lead to action, that's when real change takes hold. See you next time.